I said, well, you know, there's 60 million people living in rural America. It's the size of a good-sized European country. That would be enough data for us to really try to figure out how to help patients.
Hi, welcome to HIMSCast. I'm Kat Jersich, Senior Editor at Healthcare IT News. Patients in rural parts of the United States often face specific and numerous barriers to care, including financial hurdles, logistical concerns, and trust in the healthcare system. As the executive director of the National Rural Accountable Care Consortium and the founder and executive chair of Caravan Health, our guest today is deeply involved in rural health policy. She's also a pioneer in implementing value-based payment models in Medicare. Lynn Barr, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really passionate about the topics we're going to discuss today.
Maybe you could just get started by explaining a little bit about your background in rural health policy. I know you've been in this work for many, many years at this point. So why don't you just give listeners a little information about you and your work?
Oh, thank you so much. I was a serial entrepreneur and did a series of startups in the drugs, devices, diagnostics area. And at the end of the day, I had 13 products I'd taken through the FDA and worldwide markets, and we really had no idea what they actually do to patients. And so I had this dream about trying to get real data from patients and to be able to better understand what really happens when we do all the interventions that are prescribed to us, because clinical trials are very ivory tower and the vast majority of drugs are used off label. So I went back to school to get my master's in public health. I went to the University of California. It was a great experience at 50. And you know, my intention was, this is so like old school, 2010, I was going to try to get people to adopt electronic health records so I could access the data. And my first semester, the High Tech Act passed. So I'm like, oh, I'm doing pretty good here. I said, you're welcome.
So that's a big accomplishment. Okay.
Now what? And so with all of the funding towards health information technology and exchange, I got involved and I had to do an internship, which was super awkward. I'd been a CEO. I haven't had a boss since 1998, right? And so I had to be an intern, and I was lucky enough to work with Jonah Frohlich, who was the Secretary of Health Information Technology and Exchange in the state of California, and to help him write the plan with Manat, of course, and to write the plan for the state on health information technology and exchange. We convened about 600 stakeholders across the country, across the state. And I had one of my cohorts was the rural providers. And what became instantly obvious was that the big systems in California, the big provider groups, nobody wanted to exchange data. They would send it somewhere, but you couldn't keep it, you know, you couldn't use it, you know, and the idea that, you know, everything was going to be transaction-based seemed impossible to me, I think, as we've learned over time. So the one cohort that I had of people that were willing to share their data were our rural providers, and they were really interested in it because they didn't have any access. They didn't have enough data for it to be a big deal to them, you know, from a proprietary perspective. And so they were like, yeah, you can, we'll share our data with you. You know, will you share back? Will you tell us what you learned? And I said, absolutely. When I left school, I took a job as a CIO at a rural hospital to get a sense of what that actually is like. And I convened the states under a loan program, got them all set up, or the rural providers under a loan program with United, got them all set up on EMRs and went through all that pain and suffering with them, and realized that culture is really a big part of the issue. So I said, well, you know, there's 60 million people living in rural America. It's the size of a good-sized European country. That would be enough data for us to really try to figure out how to help patients. And they seem willing. So I started organizing them into accountable care organizations because the MSSP had the best data in the country. It was the only clean data set. And I'd just come out of the School of Public Health with, you know, all my access to all their wonderful data, and it was garbage. There was nothing you could do with any of it and compared to what you could do with claims data and EMR data together. So that was the beginning of that's why I started the National Rural ACL.
That's really, really exciting. And thank you for kind of talking us through that. As a Californian myself, originally I live in Chicago now, I have a lot of affection for the state. And I know that it's more rural than people from outside of the state might think. I think it's kind of an assumption that everybody lives in San Francisco and LA, and obviously that's not the case.
Right. 95% of the state is rural, and we've got 65 rural hospitals. You know, that puts us up there with every other rural state in the country.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. But I just don't think people think California like that, except unless you're from there. I'm from outside of Sacramento, which is, again, kind of on the edge of that rural divide. And so I'm wondering, you know, given your experience as a CIO at that rural hospital, what are a few of the specific issues that you found providers and innovators facing, you know, based on that claims data?
It was funny. So the first year in the ACO, you know, I had put together the 10 leading health systems in the rural health systems independents in the country, you know, the first movers. And we were, you know, we really thought we were great. And what we learned was, you know, our first year, our quality was about the worst in the country. And our costs went up 5%. And so it was like, oh, it actually isn't how good do you think you are. It's what the data says, you know, which was a big wake up call. And, you know, remember that rural providers have largely been accepted, you know, do not have to participate in even Medicare meaningful use. You know, a lot of value-based programs, they're considered, you know, vulnerable. And so they're excused from this work, you know. But the problem is that, you know, there's been this incredible divide in life expectancy between rural Americans and urban Americans that started in the 90s, right? Mm. That's when the diverge happened, not in, you know, 50 years ago. And so, you know, as the world is moving forward into these programs, and as rural providers are being left behind and safety net providers are being left behind, it's creating bigger disparities and health inequity than ever. So that was, I think, my biggest shock.
And given those disparities and inequities, how do you see population health programs and value-based payment models as kind of addressing those disparity issues and addressing those inequities and helping these hospitals and rural health providers to increase their revenue, especially given what we also know about the effect of the pandemic on hospital longevity?
Boy, that's a great question. You know, and there's a lot to unpack there. You know, the biggest issue that I learned when I started this work was that with the HITECH Act, right? So this is the unintended consequences, probably the greatest thing that's happened in healthcare in 50 years, right? But with the HITECH Act, it became harder and harder for small and independent practices to survive. Right. Mm. And so what our rural providers did, I mean, you know, it's funny because like people would be lined up outside the CEO, physicians, local physicians would be lined up outside the CEO's door to talk about what are they going to do with their practice because they couldn't continue independently. And so they acquired the majority of practices in their communities to in order to be able to provide primary care for their communities. That was the sole purpose. And then, you know, as a result of that, they, you know, the promise to those practices was, you know, it's okay. We'll take care of you. We'll make sure you're financially sustainable and we'll leave you alone, right? We're not going to tell you what to do because we're a hospital. Right. And we don't know anything about running a practice and we respect you and we are desperate to keep you. So we'll leave you alone. And so that is the worst thing you could do to a practice today is to leave it alone because you need to create processes that produce health and quality. So, and it's not physician work. It is work that the staff does under the supervision and guidance of the physician, but the physician needs more time to spend with patients, not more time like working on quality measures. And so the most important thing that we started doing was organizing nurses in the clinics to do the heavy lifting of wellness, prevention, chronic care management, to, you know, to identify missing codes. I mean, to do all of the work that kind of the blocking and tackling of population health, and to free up the physician who was already trying to like do quality measures and things like that, so they could spend more time with patients. And that has been the key to our transformation.
What did the outcome measurement look like there? How did they track those outcomes? So they could ensure, as you mentioned, you don't want to leave these practices alone. And yeah, how did they find out that this was working?
Right. So actually, and this is where technology really came into play for us. So it's a great segue into that part of the discussion. So one of the things that we discovered, we were running 38 ACOs at a time, right? I had 38 ACOs, and every quarter I'd get a call from a CEO. Lynn, my costs went up 10%. What did you do wrong? Or Lynn, you know, I had 10% of savings. Now I've got 10%, you know, or now I've got 10% savings, you know, and I haven't even started. What, you know, what is this all about? And what we realized is that small numbers don't work, right? Duh. I mean, I'm constantly learning the obvious in this program, right? And so what every insurer knows is you can't really judge cost and quality on 100 lives, 500 lives, 1,000 lives. And it turns out that you can't judge cost on less than 100,000 lives, right? And so outcomes measures became very the wrong way to go for us. And we saw that immediately. As I had my first ACO, and we were, you know, sitting there looking at our 5% losses and our crummy quality, right? The technology that is most relevant to population health in our experience is technology that drives workflow for non-physicians and measures the leading indicators to outcomes. Because you cannot trust the outcomes. And by the time you got to an outcome, it's way too late anyway, right? So what's true about ACOs or population health or whatever, you know, the flavor of the day is in healthcare that's, you know, driving people crazy. What's true about all of those things is eventually people will stop doing what you ask them to do. And because something else comes along and they get distracted by it. And then the next thing you know, they're gone. And, you know, in a program, which is only achieving true savings of, you know, a few percent per year, that's the true savings, not the gaming and everything else, but the true savings. If you can only see a couple percent per year, right, then that means that everybody's got to do the work all the time. Otherwise, you're not going to get any shared savings. So those leading indicators and those workflow engines are really the key. So, you know, Lookio, so this is, you know, your risk stratification engine that looks at cohorts of patients. I'm going to look at the data with confidence intervals in my community. I'm going to identify where they have the highest probability of affecting change. And then I'm going to drive, and let's say that's managing their COPD patients. That's their biggest outlier population. Then I'm going to create a program where I'm going to train their pop health staff to outreach to these patients. And we're going to do some interventions with them, right? So the software's got to drive identification of the patient, tasking on the interventions, and then tracking if those interventions have been complete and giving feedback. And then ultimately also having the results and the outcomes at the end. But it's the outcomes and stuff at the end is something you get to celebrate 2 years later. It's not what you need every day.
So given that you mentioned, you know, tracking patients with COPD as one leading indicator, what are a few examples of other leading indicators that might be helpful to track in order to keep ACOs on board with this plan, and so they don't, you know, want to jump ship early?
Sure. So a great, you know, the leading indicator I think the vast majority of the industry uses is annual wellness visits, right? And so if you're not doing annual, which is a billable visit, so it's in claims. So it's, you know, there's no argument about whether you did it or not. right? If you didn't build for it, you didn't do it. Right? I can almost guarantee that. So I'm looking for claims-based leading indicators like that. We have targets for chronic care management. What percentage of their patients are in chronic care management? What percentage of them are high risk? So we've developed a very comprehensive scorecard that ties everything we measure has to have a leading indicator or we can't measure it. So the scorecard and developing that pathway for people so that, you know, you catch them in the first quarter that they've, you know, walked away from the program. You're in there every month.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today. This has been a really interesting conversation. Before I let you go, I'm curious, you know, again, given your immense experience and all these issues, and also given your role on the public policy side, what do you see as the top policy priority in terms of improving the healthcare system? I know this is a big question, but if you had to pick one or two kind of main things for legislators, either on state level or the federal level to focus on, what would you pick?
Oh my God, thank you so much for asking me this. I have a burning platform policy issue, actually. So thank you. So you know, one of the things, you know, that is always hard is, you know, as you're developing policies, you're trying to, you know, reward good actors and, you know, punish the bad actors or inefficient providers, et cetera, as we talk about on MedPAC. But it's like you say, what we learn every day is the incredibly obvious in these programs. So one of the things I learned at the University of California in the School of Public Health was the thing that just blew my mind that I didn't know before I went to that school was that the poorest patients are the sickest and most expensive. Mm-hmm. The socioeconomic determinants of health are, you know, is it the socioeconomic circumstances are the determinants of health. And so patients that are underserved are more expensive. And we know this in our dual eligibles, right? And so in the Medicare Shared Savings Program, we actually have a benchmark just for dual eligibles, right? But dual eligibles only identify a small number of the underserved. Right? They do not identify a large number. Matter of fact, you could double the effectiveness of dual eligibles just by also identifying Medicare patients that get the low income subsidy that are often not dual eligibles, right? But they're not, by definition, not dual eligibles, but they are below 150% of the federal poverty limit. So we don't have income data so that we can recognize these patients with. And so the government has no way of identifying who are safety net providers.
Interesting. Right?
And so I, you know, and in our case, we started with rural, but now about half of our patients are rural and half of them are urban, but they're all safety net hospitals. They're county hospitals, district hospitals, governmental agencies. They're the ones that care for the poor, right? And so our average spending per beneficiary, because of our pool of clients, which, like, say 90% are 340B eligible, right? Mm-hmm. So that tells you they're safety net providers. So our spend is higher than the national average. Well, of course it is, right? Because we actually take care of the poor. We don't, you know, not accept them into our practices. We take all comers. We take everyone. And the government in the Pathways program created this program called Regional Benchmarks, right? And the regional benchmarks are set on the average spend of the region, which includes the poor and everyone else. Right. Well, as you can imagine, our cost is always higher, or most of the majority of our clients are higher than the regional benchmark. So in the Medicare Shared Savings Program, we get penalized for that. Wow. On average, about 1.5%. And because we're more expensive, but it's not because we're bad actors that are out there, you know, milking the system. We're more expensive because we serve the poor. And so that is, to me, the major flaw. The ACO REACH model, which we were very, very interested in, we are not going to be able to put the majority of our clients in that model because it's 50% regional benchmark, and we'd lose tens of millions of dollars by that adjustment alone. We cannot participate in a program that was designed for the safety net.
Wow. So what, I'm just processing that because it does seem to me to be a pretty clear gap.
It's so obvious. And yeah. No, it's so obvious too. It's like, really?
Right. You know? Yeah. And so what are the steps to address that, and who might be responsible for addressing that in the near future so that so that safety net providers could be involved in the ACO REACH model?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. And so we've gathered all the data. We're going to be meeting with CMMI and showing them that. We certainly, you know, I talked about this very vehemently on MedPAC last week. So I raised the issue with MedPAC. You know, it is a regulatory issue. It is not a legislative issue at this point. I mean, Congress could always override legislation, but I think CMS, as soon as they understand the problem, they'll fix it, right? Mm-hmm. Because if we had just had our historical benchmark without this regional adjustment for us taking care of the poor, if we just had our historical benchmark, we'd be fine. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just that they wanted to create this policy for those really efficient providers that, you know, had already taken all the savings out and, you know, they were just going to get punished by having their own benchmark. And I'm like, I don't know any of those providers. I don't think anybody's actually come close to taking all the cost out of the system, but okay. You know, so they did it for them that I don't even know if those people exist, and took out like half the providers in the country. So it's really silly.
Well, I would certainly be following that with interest because that's a pretty glaring situation that you've described, and I'm interested in following up on that. So please be.
Yeah, thanks. I plan to blog on it as soon as I get my final data. I'll be putting the statistics out, but it's pretty disheartening.
Oh, well, I'll definitely want to read that. And thank you so much again, Lynn. This has been a great conversation, and I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed it as well.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it and appreciate what you do.
And to all those listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. If you liked this episode, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe. Tell your friends to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get them. Thanks so much for tuning in, and stay safe out there.